Good morning, Fran.
And Damien, this week marks the 20th anniversary of one of the biggest events in British criminal justice.
Fran, it certainly does. It's the 20th anniversary of the release of the Birmingham Six, which was an event which shook the British justice system down to its very, very core. On the 14th of March 1991, the Birmingham Six were released after being wrongfully imprisoned for 16 years for an IRA terrorist attack that they had nothing to do with.
16 years because of hypocrisy, brutality. But every dog has its day, and we're going to have ours.
Ladies and gentlemen, for 16 and a half years, we've been playing you as political scapegoats. Justice, I don't think them people in there have got the intelligence nor the honesty to spell the word, never mind dispense it.
Released prisoner Paddy Hill, and before him Richard McIlkenny, another member of the Birmingham Six. In the early 1970s, the IRA, seeking to throw off British rule in Northern Ireland and end discrimination against the Catholic minority, commenced a campaign of terrorist bombings in the UK. In October 1974, they bombed two pubs in Guildford. In November, they blew up a pub in Woolwich and then two in central Birmingham. There was intense pressure on authorities to catch the terrorists. So what did they do? The Birmingham police took into custody six Irishmen for questioning, and they then tortured them in order to extract confessions. The police did the same to three men and a woman in the Guildford bombings. And they went on to frame seven more people, the Maguire Seven, which included a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old, claiming that the seven had supplied explosives to the Guildford Four. One of the seven was Giuseppe Conlon, who died in prison in 1980. All these convictions would later be quashed. Paddy Hill is one of the Birmingham Six. Jerry Conlon, Giuseppe's son, is one of the Guildford Four. Jerry served 15 years jail and was released in 1989. Paddy Hill and Jerry Conlon are both currently in Australia. On the 20th anniversary of his release, I asked Paddy Hill what he feels as he looks back on that momentous day.
Still seems unreal at times, but when I look back on it now, little did I realise that I was leaving one nightmare for another. If you'd have told me the day I was getting out that I wouldn't have been able to handle the outside world, I would have laughed in your face. And suddenly, you know, there's an old saying, be careful what you wish for when you get it, you may not know what to do with it. And for us, that's the way it is.
Let's come to your experiences on the outside in a moment. You and the other members of the Birmingham Six, you served 16 years in jail for a terrorism attack you didn't commit. The attack was in November 1974 on two Birmingham pubs, which killed 21 people and injured 162. And after the IRA attacked the pubs in Birmingham, there was a lot of pressure on authorities to find the culprits. And you and five friends were travelling to Ireland to attend a funeral, and also I think you were also visiting a sick aunt. You were on board a ferry. And as it was about to depart, you were arrested. And that arrest commenced a nightmare, and you and the others were tortured.
Yeah, well, just to set the record straight, five of us, the only one of the six that was ever arrested was Hughie Kellick, and he was arrested in Birmingham because he wasn't travelling. He only went to the train station with us. And in respect of the other five, none of us was ever arrested. We have never been arrested for the Birmingham pub bombings. I went to the police station of my own free will to be eliminated from their inquiries. They knew we had nothing to do with the IRA. The police were told that we were not involved in IRA or any form of republicanism, that we were all long-term residents living in Birmingham, married with families, etc.
And you and the others were beaten and tortured.
We had mock executions, everything. They told us straight we could have it the easy way. And that was to sign false confession statements and that they would fill them in or else we would help them. And that was the easy way. And he said, if you don't want the easy way, the hard way. And the hard way, he made a circular motion with his finger and he says, round the walls. And that's what they did. They battered us and they played football with us for the next 3 days. Mock executions, etc. And they told us straight from the beginning that we were going to be charged. We were going to be going to trial. We were going to be found guilty. They also told us that no matter what happened in the future, nothing would ever happen to them because they were covered all the way to the top. And it's quite correct. It is true. They are covered all the way to the throat. That is why the British government has put a 75-year public immunity interest thing on our papers on the Birmingham 6, the Guildford 4 and Maguire's. So we'd all be dead and buried by the time anything comes out.
Now, you didn't confess, but four of the six did under extreme duress. And at the trial, the prosecution relied on these confessions, and they also relied on forensic evidence that they claimed that you and another accused had traces of nitroglycerin on your hands. And this evidence, it was found later to be an absurd test. If you used playing cards or if you used soap, you could be found to be positive using this test.
Yeah, well, the forensic scientist that they brought out that night was a forensic scientist called Dr. Frank Skuse. The way he put it across at our trial was that he carried out the test himself. In actual fact, he didn't. It was another scientist. And we found out years later that the actual thing that was giving him a false reading was his own cleaning fluid, because he wasn't cleaning his utensils. We also found out 3 weeks before our appeal in 1987, before the Home Office sacked him, that he was a fantasist. And that people in his own laboratory from as far back as 1971 had been begging the Home Office to remove him because he was totally and utterly incompetent. Yet they carried on using him in Irish cases and others for the next 16 years. Disgraceful.
You and the others were found guilty and you were sentenced to life and you served 16 years in prison. What was the turning point, the legal turning point that finally led to your release in 1991?
There was a number of factors. One of the biggest turning points of all was when Gerry Condon's father died. We all knew then that that was a turning point. That was a catalyst for all of us, because by that time we had people at the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and a number of very, very high-ranking government ministers and etc., Biggs Davis and other people who were looking at it. And of course, it snowballed after that with our letter campaign, which I was carrying out on behalf of the Birmingham 6 and which Gerry was carrying out on behalf of the Guildford 4. And then suddenly I was very fortunate to end up in Gartree Prison. And the Member of Parliament for that was a fellow called Sir John Farr. And he came to see me and everything started going off after that. And it just snowballed from there.
Gerry Conlon, I'll bring you in here. The experience of the Guildford 4 is remarkably similar to the Birmingham 6. In October 1974, the IRA bombed two pubs, killing five and injuring many. When you were arrested, you were also tortured and your family was threatened, and under extreme duress, you confessed.
Yeah, I did. But what happened to us is a carbon copy of what happened to the Birmingham 6. And I think that it was done deliberate to set an example to the Irish community in Britain not to come involved in Republican politics or national politics. And we were the example that they were using to deter people.
But you weren't, you know, were you? You weren't involved in Republican politics in any way, shape or form.
No, I mean, you know, I had as much trouble with the IRA when I was growing up through my activities is what the IRA I had with the British soldiers. But they took me from my home in Belfast and they battered me and tortured me in Springfield Road Police Station. And they hooded me and they took me to the airport, handcuffed me and flew me to a foreign country. We call that rendition now, state kidnapping then. But they were able to do what they want to cajole, terrorise, and still fear in the Irish community.
You were also found guilty and sentenced to life. In the case of the Guildford Four, the actual IRA bombers, the Balcombe Gang, they were eventually caught and they were found guilty of other attacks.
The Balcombe Street people were arrested after a siege at Balcombe Street. And when first interviewed by the police, they stated that the first bombings they had done had sent innocent people to prison for. And they started giving them details of how they bombed Guildford, of how they bombed Woolwich. And subsequently, because of their statements at their trial, we were granted an appeal in September of 77. And the Balcombe Street people were our main plank of evidence. And they came forward and gave crucial evidence that only the people who did the bombing could possibly know. And in fact, Sir Michael Havers, the guy who'd prosecuted us and the guy who'd prosecuted my father, he accepted what they were saying. And at the end of 5 weeks of appeal, the three judges went away and they came back with the most extraordinary concocted verdict you ever heard of. They said that they accepted that the four people who had become known as the Guildford Four didn't bomb Guildford and in all likelihood had never been to Guildford. But somehow they thought it could be possible that we may have known the people who did it. So therefore they were sending us back to jail, although they had no proof. They had no evidence to show that there was any connection. And they couldn't have, because there never was. When my father died, people knew that an innocent man had been jailed and died. And it was my father's giving his life for me, that made me take up the letter campaign to continue the good work he'd done. And you knew you were counting down the time, but you also knew that you were dealing with a government, a judiciary, a police force, a media empire that had all played their part in sending innocent people to prison. So we knew that it was still going to be tough. And especially with the situation in Ireland, with the hunger strikers, the IRA, the animosity that had built up over these murderous campaigns, not just by the IRA, but murderous campaigns by the RUC against Catholics. So these were huge hurdles to get over. But we seemed to be attracting and uniting and gathering support from the unlikeliest of quarters. And then, you know, as Paddy said, he went up on his appeal in 87, in November of 87. And another travesty of justice took place. They refused his appeal. They accepted the likes of skews and they defended the indefensible behaviour of policemen who were torturing people, performing mock execution, battering people. The time I was in Springfield Road Police Station, the time I was in Addlestone, the time I was in Godalming, I was kept absolutely naked. The whole time I was in search positions where police, young police women who were bringing refreshments, the Grundy and Jeremy and Christopher Rowe and Wally Simmons and Tim Blake, the torturers of me, were being encouraged to spit on me and stamp on my toe with their high-heeled shoes and grab my testicles and twist them. And the thing is, we're not frightened to name people and we're not frightened to shame them. What we are wanting to do is to have these people removed from their positions. The ones who received knighthoods have it taken off them because they were the facilitators of sending innocent people to prison. They were the facilitators of perjured policemen, doctored forensic evidence. You know, this was a nightmare that started in 1974 in November. This is 2011. This is 37 years after it. And we haven't had any help.
Gerry Connellan, to remind listeners, your entire family was caught up in this madness. In addition to the Guildford Four, there were the Maguire Seven, found guilty of possessing nitroglycerin. And your father, Giuseppe Connellan, who you mentioned, he died in prison in 1980. Your aunt, Anne Maguire, her husband, her two children aged 14 and 17 at the time of the bombing.
My aunt and uncle, my cousins. Vincent wanted to be a policeman. He was a police cadet. His dream was to join the Metropolitan Police. Patrick wanted to follow his father into the same regiment in the British Army that his father served in and go and fight for Queen and Country. My aunt and uncle had busts of Winston Churchill. They had become quintessentially British and embraced the British way of life and were upstanding members of the community who were well-liked. They were part of the Conservative Club. This, as I say, Damien, was designed deliberately.
You bet.
Because there was a murderous campaign that was taking place and had taken a leap beyond what anyone could imagine. The blowing up of 21 people, the indiscriminate murders at Guildford, Woolwich, Caterham and everywhere else. And this is what happens. You know, the Maguires, their lives were ruined. The same as Paddy's children's lives were ruined. They took Annie and Paddy, my aunt and uncle, Vincent and Patrick, my cousins, and they left John and Anne-Marie on the street with nowhere to go. The exact same as what they did to Paddy Hill's Mrs. Pat and his six children. Every time they moved, someone would find out who they were and they would attack the house. They were given different identities. This is a horror story, and the British government have got out of it very lightly. They let us out because public pressure across the world was building. If they could have kept us in, they would have kept us in. But letting us out the way they did after witnessing the horror and the violence and the depravity and the mental cruelty and brutality, physical brutality that exist in Category A prison, they'd have been better keeping us in. Freedom is, like Paddy says, sometimes you wish for something and when you get it, you don't know what to do with it. We're haunted by this experience. This was dirty deeds done dirt cheap by the British government, and innocent people paid the price for it.
Can we talk about that price? And you've spoken about the terrible life that you had behind bars, but of course, as you're mentioning, life hasn't become easy for you. You're still paying the price 20 years on. Speaking of family, Paddy Hill, you have, you know, a number of children. I think your son Sean was just one or so when you were arrested. Since your release, have you been able to re-establish close relationships with your children?
Not at all. I'm estranged from them probably more now than I was when I come out. Prison kills you a little bit every day in prison. You die, you bury your emotions so deep, etc. And suddenly you're waking up one morning, you don't feel nothing, and you come out and that's the way you feel. In fact, when you're with your family, you feel like an intruder. I can't explain it any better. You just don't feel right. You'd rather be in the company of strangers. And of course, I've never spoken to any of my family about what happened to me. And since Jerry's the same, he's never spoken. In fact, most of the men that have come out that I know, I don't think any of them have ever spoken to any of their families about what happened to them, about the brutality and the life in prison. It's just too painful, and it's no good giving them pain when there's no need to, you know what I mean?
Do you see your kids much these days?
Very, very little. The time that I'm spending in the studio talking to you today is more time than I spent for some of my kids in the last 5 years. That's how bad it is, you know. You just don't want to. You just don't feel nothing. And you know there is something missing. And you can't put your finger on it. You just don't know what it is. But you just don't feel a part of anything to do with them. You feel like a complete and utter stranger.
I read in your book that you feel a great deal of overload when you come out of prison. You couldn't even go to a supermarket when you first came out. Are you able to kind of move about the world easily now, 20 years on?
No. Wherever I go out, I've always got someone with me, like, you know. You still get panic attacks, etc. Of course, you don't sleep. We don't sleep. We just catnap. And when you go to bed, you only sleep for about, or catnap for an hour or two. Then you're awake and the adrenaline rush, you're sweating, your heart's pumping, and it's just flashbacks and you're waking up so tense and so angry, etc. And in the end, half the time, we don't want to go to sleep because we're so tired of waking up angry and frustrated and tired.
What would you like from the authorities and from the British state?
I'll tell you what I'd like to see. I'd like to see them, for a start, given us the truth, lift the 75-year ruling off our case papers and let the public of England see the way that we, not only we and our families, that were used and abused by the government and the police and judiciary, but also let the relatives of those who were killed and those who were injured, and even those who were injured are still alive, let them see how the British government used and abused them and the memory of those that died. And the second thing I want to see, because they keep telling us, they keep saying that we're all equal in the eyes of the law. And that's quite right. That's the way it should be. But it's only in theory. It's not in practice. And what we need is accountability. We are held accountable for our actions. Yet, the system is not held accountable for anything.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast each week on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. Today we're marking the 20th anniversary of the release of the Birmingham Six. Together with the Guildford Four and the Maguire Seven, they form one of the darkest chapters in the history of the UK's criminal justice system. London lawyer Gareth Pearce was instrumental in obtaining the release of all three groups. One of the legal turning points was when she uncovered, buried deep in a police file, a witness statement by Mr. Charlie Burke, which confirmed Gerry Conlon's alibi on the night of the Guildford bombing. and it was accompanied by a note saying, "Do not show to the defence." But the lawyer maintains that ultimately, while evidence of police misbehaviour played a part, that most English of emotions, embarrassment, was crucial in securing their release.
It probably wasn't a legal turning point. In a sense, it was probably a political turning point when the embarrassment of men who the world could see were so clearly wrongly convicted, when the embarrassment of keeping them in outweighed the considerable embarrassment of letting them out. And I think for 16 years they had crashed against the rocks on appeal after appeal because, in part, of the mindset of the implications of admitting that police had brutalised them, tortured them, fabricated evidence, forensic scientists had falsified results. It was an enormous catastrophe to have to acknowledge, but in the end, heads don't roll and the world goes on. It's the victims who have suffered it, but it is that mindset of closing ranks in the establishment. And by the time they got out, 18 very senior judges, one way or another over the years, had all forcibly reiterated that the convictions were safe. So the embarrassment factor was key either way in keeping them in and ultimately in getting them out.
We've spoken about the police and the dreadful things that they did. We've spoken, I guess, about the political environment and the failings of the politicians. What about the failings of lawyers and judges?
Everyone failed the men. Everyone. The judges, in fact, effectively, over the years, substituted themselves for a jury and a constitutional impropriety by hearing new evidence and then rejecting it and not ordering a retrial. For lawyers, well, we all failed. They were in there for so long. The original solicitors they had, when they first saw them at court and could see them bruised and cut and damaged, they managed to get legal aid forms signed but didn't manage to log the injuries, which was fatal omission for the future. And in the end, British justice was disgraced across the board. There's no doubt about it.
Well, there were never any successful convictions of the police for torture. I think the civil action failed. No heads have rolled, have they?
In the case of the Birmingham officers, there was proof positive of falsification of notebooks. And they were charged, but they successfully ran an argument that to prosecute them was an abuse of process because there had been such prejudicial publicity. And the Guildford police officers were charged and, in fact, tried. They had also falsified notes, but they had explanations which a jury accepted that it wasn't intentional falsification, it was simply having to rewrite notes to make them look tidy, something like that. However, years after those prosecutions took place of the Guildford officers, there was a different case went on in Northern Ireland relating to another wrongful conviction of Gerry Conlon's co-defendant, Paul Hill. And I had occasion then to take statements from officers who'd been on duty Guildford police station at the time.
Three,
and quite
two,
extraordinary
one.
Things were said, including admission that mock executions were taking place, guns were pointed through cell doors, and the explanation of these quite ordinary officers who had simply been in their own police station seeing what was going on was, well, we thought everyone knew all this. This is what we thought happened, that we knew happened at the time, but we didn't realise it was new to be saying this.
When this all came to light, when the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four were released, Were the lessons learnt at an institutional level? Were reforms enacted that would mean that this kind of appalling miscarriage of justice wouldn't take place again?
Yes and no. Immediately, within seconds of the judges saying that the Birmingham Six had won their appeals, the Home Secretary of the day announced a royal commission to investigate the failings of criminal procedure in this country. And it did pretty much eradicate the possibility of physical ill-treatment in a police station. It did that. It focused on potential criminal acts of police officers. So you had tape recording, lawyers present, video recording in corridors. So it removed the scope for brutality. At the same time, took on the misconception, if suspects are getting an improved position, then we should balance it off and improve the position of the prosecution. So they partially removed the right to silence by saying if someone's silent during police station questioning, the jury ultimately can draw an inference that they're guilty from their silence. So it was not a pure cleaning of the stables by any means. So have we learned the dreadful lessons of the past? I do see that occasionally what looks like a victory leads to the executive regrouping, rethinking, and achieving the same result by different means. So it's a constant battle, and it requires constant vigilance.
When people hear your extraordinary stories, what do you want them to remember?
It can happen to them.
Exactly.
It can happen to them.
And they want to remember that it is happening to other people. And yeah, if they don't get up and do something about it, then if they ever find themselves in the same predicament, they have got no right to go out asking people for help.
It's that poem, the pastor poem about the Nazis in Germany. They came for the singers and took them, and I did nothing. They came for the authors. I did nothing. And then they came for me and there was nobody left. We have to, as human beings, be strong enough and have the courage to speak out when we believe an injustice has happened. The state tries to marginalise you. You know, we've been stigmatised and all the rest. But we've, you know, because we don't care what colour you are, what religion you are, or what part of the world you're from. It's only one criteria to be innocent. And we'll fight all the way. And we were dependent on other people doing that for us while we were in prison. So it's not easy recounting your story of being tortured and father dying, children lost. Paddy, 8 years in solitary confinement, me 5 years, 18 moves around Britain. Your family's been strip searched. We have a moral obligation, a moral duty as human beings to look out for each other.
Gerry Conlon and Paddy Hill, who are currently in Australia as guests of the National Maritime Union of Australia. They're here to promote the work of Mojo, the Miscarriages of Justice organisation, which works with innocent people after their prison release. Lawyer Gareth Pearce is currently working with Paddy and Gerry to overturn the 75-year public interest immunity in their cases. That's the Law Report for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks to producer Erica Vowles and technical producer this week, Alex Stinson. Do visit our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. There you can download audio, listen to the program online, read a transcript, or leave us a comment.